Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody. This is Janine, and you are listening to Lunch with Lawton. Coffee Talk radio shows are part of the Coffee Party Be the Media project. You can join our team by going to www.coffeepartyusa.com/volunteer and let us know, I want to be the media. Hey, so today is Halloween. It's a very special day to me. My past husband and I were married on this day, and so it's always kind of a fun party. Exciting day for me, and I really wanted to start the show with the Monster Mash, but I couldn't do it because I'm not techie enough, and all my techie friends are on vacation. So imagine me singing the Monster Mash to you, and we probably would have gotten it then. So here I am in the foothills of the Oregon Coast Range. Debbie Lynn Molyneux, my co-pilot, is north of here a couple hours in Portlandia. Say hello, Debbie Lynn.
Hey, everybody. And I had no idea you got married on Halloween with one of your marriages. I did, too. It was so much
did
fun
you?
To have the reception as a costume party.
Exactly. A costume wedding was the most wonderful thing in the world. We'll have to talk about this some other time, Debbie.
Another
Isn't
time,
that amazing?
Yes.
Yes, yes. So here we are today. Our subject is health insurance and you. And we're looking for people's experience in signing up, at sort of taking on the task of taking that first step in this new sort of shift in the orientation we're trying to take health coverage for health care in our country. I wanted to sort of start out with a little background information. We've been posting about this for a week now. We've gotten a lot of comments in, and some need to be shared. If you're interested in the source of a lot of this information that sounds factual, virtually every article that I'm going to be plagiarizing, so to speak, quoting from or extrapolating from, is posted on our Facebook page, Lunch with Lawton. So you can go there and get the background information straight from the horse's mouth. We're hoping for a no-spin zone today. We're hoping for civility and reason because we want to hear your personal experiences about Obamacare enrollment. How about a little background here? What is Obamacare? To be clear, because it started in controversy that continues today and sometimes sort of gets, I think, intellectually challenged about what it is exactly that we're talking about. So there was an Affordable Health Care Act for America, drafted but never became law. In December of 2009, the Senate passed an alternative health care bill, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. In 2010, the House abandoned its reform bill in favor of amending the Senate bill, and, you know, law was born. There was a late-night vote in the House. It ended up 220 to 215. The bill passed with support from a majority of Democrats together with one Republican who voted only after the necessary 218 votes had already been cast. 39 Democrats voted against the bill. All members of the House voted, none voting present. That's significant. There was a yay or nay vote from everyone. After all that negotiating, though, this is the twist for me. Lots of negotiating, lots of conversation, all the morphing away from Medicare for All, a big contender at one end of the political spectrum, and towards a market-oriented program. All that compromise, and yet only one Republican voted yes. That was the day I knew that there was mischief in the ship of state and that schemers were at the helm of this because it didn't make sense. It didn't jive. I felt the vote was disingenuous. Like, how can you do all this work to compromise and then still not get any support? That was odd. It is not our political tradition. So, by coincidence or not, the Coffee Party itself was born just about this time. And I believe that's because the vitriol from the healthcare debate had brought the national temperature to a real boil. It was hot. a lot of us will remember that. So now, there are specifics that have been shared on the Facebook page. I'm just going to touch on some background info about the ones that come up most often, and then we'll bring in more conversation from someone besides me. One thing, budget setbacks. What does that mean? Well, there's been a conversation since before the law was passed about what it would cost to implement and manage this program. There was a Supreme Court test that sort of brought the program to, you know, second gear, slowed it down. A presidential election with Obamacare in the balance, slowed it down. And then so many states, an unexpected 26 states opting out of providing exchanges and opting out of Medicaid expansion. Funding and time became issues. Congress refused a requested budget increase prompted by these circumstances. Some say by design, some don't. What about policy cancellation? Background. According to Wendell Potter, Center for Public Integrity, and a former insurance broker, policy cancellation is a standard strategy in that industry for managing profitability. Meanwhile, the notion that this is new to Obamacare is incorrect. He tells us some clients being sent letters that their policy had been canceled rather than modified due to new Obamacare standards and a replacement policy offer that would work out for the company. Not all the available replacement policies, the one that protected profit. I'm wondering if anyone else out there had that experience, and we'd love to hear about it. What does it mean when a state doesn't participate? Non-participation looks like, to me, the original bill failed and the replacement bill was negotiated. Not only are half the states not creating their own exchanges, they're also not accepting Medicaid expansion, leaving a poverty gap for those unable to comply because without the federal subsidy, they cannot afford coverage. And this is acknowledged, and an exemption for penalty has been given to these people. The non-participating states virtually created a coverage donut hole for those who make too much for welfare but not enough to participate in exchange without financial help. I saw a number, it was millions of people, but I don't remember, I'll find that number. I really hope we hear from people in this situation. And then, of course, there's the website failures. The failure of the website to perform. Some say that this is a curious product of a failed procurement system and management by folks with virtually no tech savvy. Last night on Chris Hayes, I heard Clay Johnson from the Department of Technology say that watching the hearing yesterday was like watching people who can't read and can't write give a book review. The quote I wrote down was, these people had no idea what they were talking about. So the technical conversation wasn't a winner in the hearings. So regardless, the pre-show comments on Join the Coffee Party Movement are not hugely indicting of the site and express patience in working things out. Many use the phone and had no trouble, a simple and productive enrollment on their state exchanges. So now, it's your turn. How has this gone for you? Call in at 646-929-2495. Share. You can express yourself in chat. You can express yourself on Lunch with Loudon Facebook page and on Join the Coffee Party Movement page. But before we go on, Debbie Lynn, would you please introduce our guest today, Michael Charney?
I will. And just to fill in that number for you, the number of people that are going to be left in the donut hole is 14 million.
14 million people. Okay.
14 million people. So welcome. So thanks for that and for that setup. And our guest, Michael Charney, has experienced the exchange firsthand. He's a former Coffee Party board member. He's also a sole proprietor in the consulting, coaching, and publishing industry. He's author of Tea with the Mad Hatter, which if you join the Coffee Party, become a member, you get a free copy of that. And I'd just like to welcome Michael to the show. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you very much, both. It's good to be back.
I hear your voice.
And I should have said, yes, former co-host with Eric Beiler, too, on Tuesday night. You had your own show with us for a while.
Yes, for the better part of more than a year.
Excellent, excellent. So, Michael, you, one of my earliest posts about this, you know, leading up to today's show, ended up in a really lovely exchange between you and another poster about your personal situation. And so maybe the way to start is for you to just explain to us how Obamacare enrollment proceeded and worked out for you.
Right. Okay. So just a little bit of background. Up until 2010, I had been a corporate person my whole life and had never been in a situation where I needed to buy my own insurance with a sort of asterisk exception of a couple of occasions where I was on COBRA when I, you know, a company I was with folded or I got laid off. But I had never had to go out and buy my own. And I did that in 2011 or late 2011, something like that, when my COBRA was running out. And got a pretty decent policy through Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield here in New Hampshire. And that policy has held steady in the intervening 2.5 years or whatever, or 2 years or so. There were no changes to it on my annual on the annual turnover. The increase in the rate from year one to year two was about 3%, which I didn't think was terribly outrageous. As a matter of fact, I remember being pleasantly surprised that it hadn't gone
through
the roof.
Oh, that's unbelievably good.
Both in our mid-50s, and we have no significant pre-existing conditions or anything like that, no big health history to deal with. I had a previous history as a smoker, which apparently the insurance company had, you know, some number of years, even if it's been years since you haven't smoked, they sort of still rate you a little bit. So I paid a little bit more for that. But I wasn't terribly disappointed either with the coverage, my deductible, my choices of doctors, the coverage for the various medications, the formularies, as they call it. It was a pretty good deal. Not great, but I don't think anybody has a great deal in healthcare. But I was not complaining. And about a month ago, I got the letter, right? And this was actually before any news had hit in the media about these letters starting to go out. And so I didn't know exactly why I was getting it. But essentially, I was told that my policy had been canceled and that I would be given an option of the new policies that would be available. Now, at the time, Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield offered roughly, I think I counted the numbers, either 22 or 24 different plan options to me. And that was being cut to 6, which surprisingly were called bronze, silver, and gold, 2 in each category, which I thought demonstrated an insane lack of creativity on the part of the marketing people at Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield, but nevertheless. So I was down to these 6 plans. And I was told I had until, you know, basically my renewal date, which is February 1st, to make up my mind. And I looked at the plans that they offered, and the plans were roughly in the range of 20% more expensive than what I was paying, with, in my case, much worse coverage. That is, my deductible for myself and my wife would have doubled. Obviously, the premiums were up 20%. They had limited somewhat dramatically the doctors that were available, and they were limiting the formularies as well. So all the kinds of things I was afraid of when I first signed up that weren't true were now true. So I thought, well, if this is the case, I'll go look at the exchange. I'll see what Obamacare has to offer. A point of information, New Hampshire is one of those 26 states, so I had to go to the federal exchange. And I think this is a very telling point for why many people's experiences differ. New Hampshire turns out to have only one vendor on the exchange, Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield. There's no competition here at all. There's only one provider. And I think that's an important factor for a lot of people. So I went and looked at the exchange and looked at the plans, and they were identical. They weren't just close. they were the same. The premiums were the same, exactly as the six that were offered to me by Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield. It was the same option. So I took a look at my own personal situation. I thought, well, if it's the same either way, why not use the exchange? And the reason for making that decision was that as a sole proprietor, if I have a bad year, knock wood, I don't want to have a bad year, but if we have a bad year, then at least I could get some relief in terms of premium support, which for those of you who are unaware of it, you do not have to take it as you go. You can pay the full boat on your premium, and if it turns out that you're eligible for the credit, then you take it off your taxes at the end of the year. So I thought, well, that at least gives me some protection. If I have a little bit of a down year, I may get some help in through Obamacare that I wouldn't get if I signed up for the exact same plan directly. So I decided I would sign up for the exchange. So right off the bat, before I even get into my experiences on the exchange, which I've written
but
about.
But that's good information. I've never heard that before, that if your eligibility faltered, that you had a tax relief, there was tax relief for that. So that's
Yes. And in fact, it works the other way. It works the other way for all you sole proprietors out there. If you think, and the threshold, in my, I don't know if this is the case for everybody, family of two, the threshold was 67.5. So if as a family of two, if we make less than 67.5, there is a sliding scale of relief available to us, right? Now, I would not be at all happy if our business only generated that. But, you know, it's sort of a little bit of a safety net in the event of, you know, a disastrous business year, that there would be some relief. It works the other way, too. If you take the relief and end up earning more than whatever your family's threshold is, then you have to pay that back on your taxes. And by the way, it's not an all or none. This is just information that's tangential. But let's say your relief, you know, and there's a calculator on the Obamacare website that will help you figure out what your relief should be. And let's say the estimate is that your relief would be $500 a month. I'm just picking a number. You can choose to have, say, $200 a month applied against your premium and leave and not take $300 of it and wait and get that back as a credit at the end of the year. So, you know, if your income levels change, then you won't necessarily be caught with a big tax bill if you've taken too much credit. So any of you with sole proprietors, I strongly advise do a little math and look at your options in terms of how you take that credit, because you may or may not be eligible for it depending on how your business does next year. And it's based on 2014, but they're estimating your credits based on 2012 income, which is the last tax year they have. Side note, which is a little scary, I did not have to provide any of that information on the website. They already knew it. it was already, the whole system was already tied into my tax records and knew everything.
Yeah, and that's part of what the complexity of the system is, too. So anyway,
no question, and of course it's created a lot of red herrings, or, you know, the HIPAA story and whatever. So, my experience on the exchange itself was, you know, it was a nightmare to me, but I've heard worse. For a couple of weeks, I just couldn't get in at all. Or a week or so, I could not get in at all, along with everybody else who couldn't get in. And I thought, okay. And by the way, I waited like a week or two to even start, or a week and a half to start, because I figured there would be a big rush at the beginning. And having lots of experience in managing enterprise software projects, of which this is exponentially more complex, I wasn't at all surprised that they misestimated what their load requirements would be. So I waited a bit. Still couldn't get in for a while. Then I got in, and I was able to almost complete things. And then I would get locked out, and then I had to start over. And this happened a couple of times. And then I finally got through to the point where I had completed what they call the application, which is not actually choosing your plan yet. It's just applying and basically getting your record into the system and saved. And then the next step after you do that is to select a plan. Well, the system wouldn't let me. It wouldn't let me in anywhere to even look at the plans again, and I'd already seen them, so I knew they were there. I knew they were up and available, but I couldn't get back into them at all. I ended up getting a chat person on the line. And I used to think that maybe people who do telemarketing have the most thankless job in the world. I'm not so sure anymore. The customer service person that I dealt with for the ACA site was very, very nice and very, very, well, I shouldn't say very, very helpful. It was, she had no control over anything. Her advice to me, and I laugh now, but I was irritated at the time. Her advice to me was to try to log back in the middle of the night when traffic would be lower. That was the advice I got. Log, you know, set your alarm. She didn't say that, obviously. But she did say, try logging back in the middle of the night. The loads are usually much lighter then. And yeah, it's because people want to sleep. I did not take that advice. I tried again over the next few days and finally got in and was able to go through and finish the process. There were a couple things about it. Even apart from the technical debacle, which I think is the only fair word, there are just some things about the design that are really stupid. So, for example, imagine if I went to Best Buy and I picked up some item and it didn't have a price on it. Imagine having to go to a person or go to the checkout and say, I'd like to find out what the price of this is. And they said, well, first I need your name and I need your address and I need your Social Security number and I need you to tell me about this information and that information and that information. And once I get all that in the system, then you can do a price check.
Mm-hmm.
It's absurd. The fact that you can't go onto the site and just check the prices of the available plans and the features without having to first register with the site, I think, is a major design flaw.
Well,
and probably contributes to the load, because I'm sure a lot of people might look at it and could quickly look at it and say, I'm not interested in that, and go away and not bog down the system with having to register. So I found that kind of annoying. But I did finally get all through it. The punchline for me is, and by the way, I ended up choosing a plan that is more expensive, that has, and again, it's the same one that I could have chosen at Anthem, has double my deductible. So I may never hit my deductible. It sort of becomes catastrophic insurance for me because the deductible is pretty high. And I chose the lowest one, the second lowest one available to me. My wife, who has a very good doctor who's been working with her because she's osteopenic, pre-osteoarthritis. She has a very good doctor. She can no longer work with that doctor because, unlike the previous plan, not only has that doctor been thrown out of the network, but the plan doesn't allow any payment at all for an out-of-network. So it used to be if I went in-plan, they'd pay 80%. If I went out-of-plan, they'd pay 50%. Now if I go out-of-plan, they don't pay anything. So she's lost her doctor. And you could say, well, that's my choice, but yes, it is, but that's a very expensive choice, right? And she's on a specific formulary for her osteomedication, which runs about $480 a month, which is no longer covered because it's been thrown out of the formulary. It's a compound medication. All compounded medications have been thrown out of the formulary. They're not covered anymore. So from my point of view, it's, you know, and I'm a middle-class guy making a middle-class living. I have a nice house, you know, and I got a couple dogs, and, you know, I live in a nice neighborhood, pay my bills, pay my taxes, work hard, basic middle-class Joe, and I'm getting screwed, quite frankly.
Well, I am shocked to hear that there's no out-of-plan payment. And of course,
zero.
This is, of course, your policy in New Hampshire. But I had no idea that that would be even allowable. And then the medication thing is the thing that I've heard a lot of concern about. You know what I'm saying? There are many people in the world who have expensive medications. And, of course, this is one of the things that they were able to cherry-pick away from in the past, right? You know, you could say, well, although your plan did cover it, but I'm just saying that this is an interesting development. So we're getting excellent facts here, Michael. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate it a lot.
You know, in fairness, it's one person's experience in one small state, one of the 26 that does not have its own exchange. So my experience may be very different from other people's.
But
for a lot of people, the drugs are interesting, Janine, because they haven't published the list yet. So many, many people are in the position of having to make decisions without knowing for sure if their drug is or is not going to be covered. And I think that's another flaw in the rollout.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, my wife's medication is what's called compounded, which is they actually make
right.
it every time, right? And we have,
yes.
we're lucky. I have a local pharmacy, a real old-style pharmacy 2 miles from my house that makes drugs. They make the stuff.
Right.
And we were told straight out, all compounded medication is out of the plan. So
right.
for me, I know for a fact. But many people are going into this not knowing if their expensive medications are going to be covered at all and having to make a decision on which plan to choose, not knowing.
I think that would be very difficult, you know, because if
yeah.
your condition is medication dependent, that would be a huge thing.
Right, and it's probably pushing some people to take perhaps more comprehensive or more expensive plans than they might otherwise, because obviously there is a difference in the formularies and the plans that you take.
Well, and I just want to give a comparison here because I haven't done any. I had kind of before October 1, I kind of went on coveroregon.com because Oregon is doing their own state plan. They are participating in creating a state exchange. And I just kind of went, oh, okay, well, here's about one. And they have an option where I could just put in my zip code, my estimated annual income, and they would say, okay, well, you're going to be eligible for this kind of subsidies or not, depending on, because I tried several different income levels, because like you being self-employed, Michael, you know, I don't know what
mm-hmm.
my income necessarily is going to be next year. So I tried several different levels, and it broke it around the $40,000 a year level for a single person or 37 as to whether or not it would qualify for subsidies. And just now, while you were telling your story, I went back to coveroregon.com because I have not signed up yet. You can't actually you can't buy anything yet, but I put in my zip code, my estimated income, and it popped up with 76 plans
wow.
that I get to choose from.
How many providers?
One. Oh, hold on. I'm on the wrong page for that. But yeah, it is.
Well, when I took a look, basically all Oregon providers continue to participate.
There's at least seven. And our plans are also called bronze, silver, and gold. It's similar to what yours are. But without asking for any of the background detailed information, because I can't sign up yet, it's giving me rates of what estimated monthly is, and then I can view details of the plan of what the deductible is, what the out-of-pocket maximums are, and what prescription drug coverage there is or is not, and what office visit costs, et cetera. It's all, like, there.
And you can do that without registering. That's great. That's
without
good design.
Without registering.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I just want to, you know, I think it's going to be a state-by-state case where you
well,
a
26-state versus 24-state case.
Yeah. True.
Yeah, it's half the country. It's actually, I think, more than half the population.
Right. I think it's 60% of the population is
yeah.
not going to be covered by the state exchanges because they chose
right.
not to participate. The state legislatures and or the governor chose not to participate in that. So here I am. I can't sign up yet because they won't let us buy anything until about the middle of November in Oregon. So
mm-hmm.
this was actually my first time of going on and seeing what the plans were. So I'm astounded.
Yeah,
right.
it's not been a good experience.
Well, and the range
yeah.
is huge in Oregon. I've been shopping for my adult children to make sure, you know, sort of not doing it for them, but gathering information, getting my feet wet doing this, and the ability to shop has been there since they had a countdown clock for the launch, and the minute that countdown clock went to zero, it was up, and everyone was, you know, the choice is huge here. So
mm-hmm.
I feel very lucky. So Debbie Lynn, I'd like to go to your situation next to ask you a few more questions, but we've had a couple of callers waiting for 18 and 20 minutes. So I'm going to go quickly to area code 620 and open, I believe this is Jack's mic, but then we'll come back for Debbie Lynn's experience, her total experience here. So Jack, welcome to Lunch with Loudon. Do you have an experience in enrolling for Obamacare?
Well, fortunately, I'm 82, and I have my own insurance, but, I mean, I'm listening, I believe, this mic rather than I believe anything the Republicans say. Okay. Yes, there are some
exceptions. Well, in fairness, Jack, I'm a Republican.
Yeah,
I'm saying
that the Tea Party guys, you know.
Yeah, I know. I'm with you there.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I have an experience. I have, it's fortunate. I live in Kansas. I live in Oklahoma, actually, but I have a Kansas post office box. So I'm Kansas, so Kansas and not Oklahoma, as far as post office goes. I got a bill for $183 from what's the name of that hospital?
So Jack, you're in your 80s. And so you're probably on Medicare, right?
Yeah, I have the Medicare. Crosslink or something like that.
Right, and so far it looks like, or at least the promise was that Medicare wouldn't be affected by this at all.
I called up this morning, and it looks like I talked to one of the, an $183 bill for wound care. You know, the wound care was in my butt. So they're going to, so as far as I'm concerned, they're going to pay it, $183. So I'm lucky there with the, with having, being Kansas Blue Cross and looking for, let's say they'll pay it, just disregard that bill. I guess I'm lucky with the medication. There are certain medications that I lived in for about almost 2 months at Pioneer Manor. It was a nursing home because I had somebody push me and I fell and I couldn't walk. Thank God I can walk without a walker from I'm living in a small rented house, and I'm living without the walker, walking without the walker some near the bathroom, maybe 10, 15 feet, near the end of the house, maybe 20 feet. Pretty soon, with the aid of God, thank God. I'll be free.
Well, Jack, I think I just posted an article in chat that sort of explains the relationship between Medicare and the Obamacare. And basically, there are some happy accidents, I believe, but they are not the same. And so maybe what you could do is sort of check and see how that worked out for in terms of the information that's provided there. I am glad you have good insurance. I know you're a retired public employee, and I'm glad that you're able to be taken care of. Hey, can you stay on with us? And if we have other questions about the relationship between Medicare and Obamacare, we can come back to you.
Well, it's not Obamacare. In fact, I don't even like that term. Obama accepted it himself.
I
call it the ACA, that tells us the American Care Act. I think I accept it for what it is. Most Republicans in Congress, I mean, particularly in the House, just saying, dismissing out of hand the benefits. If even Romney himself originated it in Massachusetts.
Exactly. We may have time at the end of the show to talk more about the political aspects of this. Today we want to talk about our personal experience. So, Jack, thank you as always for calling, and hang on if you think you might be available for later questions.
Okay.
So, Debbie's in. You are in the position, like Michael, being a sole proprietor, or a self-employed person, and you said that you were actually considering paying the penalty and not taking coverage. Where has that conversation gone for you?
Well, it's been interesting because I've, having been self-employed for most of the last 20 years, I haven't had insurance. A couple of exceptions for, 3 or 4 years where I worked for somebody else. But most of the last 20-plus years, I have gone without insurance, and I just pay cash for everything I need. That includes a surgery that I had. And it's kind of this, it's kind of a crapshoot. So for me, my medical costs are actually almost nothing. And so just signing up for health insurance is going to increase my health care costs by thousands of dollars a year, similar to Michael. Or I could pay a $100 penalty. Here's 95, I think it is. So on one hand, it's like I know that for Obamacare or the ACA to work, people like me need to sign up so that we can mitigate the costs for everyone. And in case I would, God forbid, get actually ill, I would have some coverage. But it's a hard decision to make when we're talking, putting another $300 a month or $350 a month into my budget for something that, I may not ever use.
Right. I think that you represent a large segment of the population who have been fortunate and have been able to get by without health insurance. Of course, we know the background, and I can post this link in chat, that 17% of bankruptcies in the United States are due to medical expenses, and that that's a
and that includes people with coverage.
Thank you, Michael. Yes. I was going to say that. I think a lot of people who declare bankruptcy for medical expenses actually have insurance.
Right.
It's not just people like me.
The difference being that various aspects of this current legislation alter their liability. In other words, people were halfway through cancer treatments and got their policies canceled, right? I mean, people were insured and then they weren't. That's a big chunk of it. And then, of course, there's what has been interestingly called the last few days in the media, junk insurance. And I think we've all had the opportunity to have junk insurance where you pay $50 a month, you pay $100 a month, but when the chips are down, it doesn't do much. And so while that's not true of all major medical or crisis-based, insurance, that would pay for your open-heart surgery, but it won't pay for a flu immunization. I think that's sort of one of the pieces I read yesterday talked about how when you ask people about their coverage, many, many people don't even know what their coverage is until they have need to use it. Of course, there's people like you, me, and Michael, who you two are self-employed. I had employees, and so I was always shopping this for them. So I knew everything about their coverage because I needed to be able to compare kind of the apples and oranges that you get when you go shop for insurance on the open market. So to me, this would have been a great thing to be able to say, this is actually what we're buying. But so I was also advised, though, by an insurance broker for a different nonprofit I'm a director for, and they basically said, you know, the penalty is so low that until there's teeth in the penalty, this is a viable option. Do you know what the penalty is?
Well, it's one for the first year, it's 1% of your income or $95. The second year, it's 2%. The third year, it's 3%.
So there you go. And if you're, you know, in that position where you've never had insurance and you've never budgeted for that, I don't know. For me, a corporation with employees, this is just a part of our overhead. You know, so when we just had to factor it in. But we were getting getting increases in double digits starting in the early 90s, and it was very difficult to have provide insurance. Anything more you want to say about this choice you're facing?
Well, I just it's interesting to have, you know, my individual needs are being different than what the community needs. The community needs me to sign up, and my individual finances say don't do that, you know, because I, you know, I'm probably never going to use it. So it's, you know, and I'm not that young. I mean, I'm almost 50. I'm just thinking of like all of the 20 and 30 somethings that I've talked to that are like, no, hell no, I'm not signing up. I haven't found one yet who's signing up. I have to be honest with you.
So my son who's 26 will be signing up.
Yeah. Yay, there's one. And I know that in order for ACA to work, people like me have to sign up. And it's the price as we move, you know, closer and closer to actually providing coverage for everybody, you know, providing actual health care instead of sick care. It's what needs to happen. And so it's an interesting dilemma.
Excellent. Well, we have a person from chat who's calling in to share some, what's the quote? I'm going to hold to tell you my nightmare. So we're looking forward to this. I'm opening up your mic. It might take just a second. Welcome to Lunch with Loudon. Who am I speaking with today?
Hi, this is Lewis from California.
Hey, Lewis, you have a nightmare to share.
Yeah, well, so, and let me just give you a little background. My wife is the benefits manager, the HR manager for benefits in her company. I work for an insurance company in another line in workers' comp. But so we're very familiar with the entire thing. So on 10-1, my wife spent a month going around telling people, well, if you were paying $400 for your insurance, now you're going to be paying close to $900, which, of course, we can't afford. None of the people in her company can afford it if they have a family. So I said, well, it doesn't matter because we're going to go to Obamacare. You know, the politicians promised us. I'm sure their promises are going to be kept. So 10-1, you know, at 6 o'clock in the morning, I get up, fire up the computer, and try to sign on. It took me about 12 hours on, you know, cumulative 12 hours in about 4 different days, but I finally got on, and I see my daughters don't qualify because when I was laid off about 6 months ago, we put them through Healthy Families, which California, they got rid of it. So now they're in Medi-Cal until they let us know if they qualify for Medi-Cal, which we know they don't because Medi-Cal is for low-income individuals. Now, so my girls don't qualify, my wife doesn't qualify, but I qualify for a plan that's about $350 with 0% subsidies. So, you know, I get on the phone and I ask them, how come there's no subsidies on this? Our income certainly meets the requirements. We don't make much money now that I'm on unemployment. You know, my wife doesn't make that much money. And what we're going to pay is about, I think we figure it was about $9,000 a month for the family, a year. For the family, so it's certainly above the 9.5% that you guys are saying that meets the affordability. And they, you know, and the response was, well, because if the employer where you guys are getting the insurance from gives the employee, in this case my wife, the coverage at less than 9.5% of her gross income, then no one in the family qualifies for any subsidies. So in other words, a family that makes $50,000 a year, let's say, would if the individual, the person that works there, pays more than, let's use 10% for math purposes, 10% of their income, the family qualifies. But guess what the company did? The companies went around and said, okay, let's make sure that no one earns more than 9.5. Nobody pays more than 9.5% for their self-coverage. So in our case, I'm stuck with a $900 a month while making $50,000 a year. So we're talking after taxes, we're talking about between $36,000 and $40,000. And out of that, we're going to have to pay about $10,000 to have access to the doctor without any insurance. So they tell me, okay, well, call Medi-Cal. You know, I mean, now you qualify for Medi-Cal because you're unemployed. All right, so I get on the phone with Medi-Cal. And now we're talking about 2 weeks into this nightmare. I'm having acid, you know, because I'm thinking, well, we're going to live under the bridge. My sister-in-law's calling me because she's paying about $800 a month. My brother's calling me because his insurance went up. So I call Medi-Cal and say, well, I'm unemployed. I know my wife has affordable insurance. My girls, right now, they have Medi-Cal, which it's unbelievable that a family that considers itself middle class now has to depend on the government without ever wanting to ask the government for help. So I call Medi-Cal, and nobody wants to give me answers. Okay, what's the income that I need to have, you know? Well, just send us your information. And they're even asking, if you became a citizen, they're asking for the certificate that they give to you when you wave your little flag and swear to be a good U.S. citizen. So they're asking for a lot of information. And I tell them, okay, so what if I sent all of this? What's the answer? Well, do you own property? Well, no, I don't own a house. We lost it in foreclosure. Well, do you have, you know, $20,000 in the bank? No, we don't have that kind of money in the bank. Okay, so do you own a car? Well, in California, I would say 99% of the people own a car. Yeah, oh, so you have property, so we wouldn't be able to insure you through Medi-Cal. I said, okay, so what's going to happen when you guys drop my daughters? Well, you can go through Obamacare. Okay, let's go through Obamacare. $250 for each. So we're talking $800 for me and my girls, and about $150 for my wife. And I said, okay, so, you know, we're still, you know, it's super expensive. Their answer was, well, you're saving $50. Oh, thank you, you know, but no, thank you. I mean, you know, it's just an unbelievable thing that the 9% is there, and they're calling it a glitch, as if when, you know, when I write a program on the computer or something, you know, an A instead of an O comes out. It's not a glitch. It's the way to send us all into poverty, because a family, you know, in this case, you know, I'll find a job eventually, and we'll be back making more than $100,000 a year. My salary was $80,000. My sister-in-law, between both of them, make $55,000 a year. Their insurance is $750. After taxes, they get about $2,500. Insurance, their rent is $1,500. Insurance is $750. So with $300, I think they're supposed to eat, put gas, pay the bills. I mean, this is it's such a ludicrous law. It's such a law that has an intent that I'm afraid of what the real intent is behind. I hope that it's just to make us beg for a single payer system where I want to be in Medi-Cal. But you know, I mean, that's beyond my scope of the call right now.
Right. Now, let me get some information clear, because this is all very concerning. So you're in California. California did not opt out, correct? Is that?
No, we have an exchange.
California, you have your own exchange, which means you should have that Medicaid supplement from the feds. But what you're saying is that the 9.5% limitation that you gave, I found the link when you brought it up in chat and put it up in our chat room, and is sort of the designing factor here. One of the other factors that I've read about is that because individual states' Medicaid programs vary so differently, the ability to participate in this is very different from state to state. And so one of the states cited was California, who said basically if you made more than $11 a month, you didn't qualify for social welfare or the social safety
exactly.
net.
Exactly.
And I find that startling. Now, the one question I get from having listened to your story so far is your wife's plan not one that you can sign up yourself and your daughters on?
Oh, yeah, I can. No, I can at the tune of $850 a month, which if you do the math,
it's
about...
So it's your wife's plan. Right,
exactly.
It's your wife's plan that costs you this money. And then without a plan, like if you were, your daughters were independent, they don't qualify for Medicaid in California?
They don't qualify for Medi-Cal because the income to be on Medi-Cal is, it's so low that if you make more than $70,000 a year, which we do right now with unemployment, my girls don't qualify for Medi-Cal. So they got rid of healthy families, which would allow, you know, a higher income. Healthy families, I think in other states, you guys, it's children's insurance or something like that. So the linchpin right here is the 9.5%. Even Walmart, an employee that makes, I think the average of Walmart is about $10 an hour. So we're talking about $20,000. Theoretically, an employee of Walmart, his family would not qualify for subsidies because their self plan, meaning for the employee, the health insurance policy, it's below 9.5% of the employee's gross income. So in theory, they don't qualify. Now, yeah, granted, they could go to Medi-Cal, you know, I mean, but the law was supposed to get these Walmarts to be accountable, to get these employers to be accountable. What in fact it did, it created people to go around and say, okay, the lowest paid employee cannot pay more than 9.5% so that we don't have to subsidize the family through paying taxes. And instead of now covering, you know, 90% of the family's cost, you know, like before we were paying like $350, they said, you know what, we're just going to cover about, you know, 15%, you know. So now families like my brother, my sister-in-law, we're paying close to $1,000 for insurance through employers. And when you turn to Obamacare, yes, you qualify through Obamacare. I mean, he's not limiting you in buying insurance, but you get no subsidies. And they wash their hands by saying, well, you have access to affordable, you know, care through my wife. Yes, my wife has access to affordable mm-hmm. care. I don't. Neither do my children. And so you say, well, I'll get a job and I'll have affordable care. But guess what? My children don't. So my children will always be, you know, and I'm going to exaggerate, they will always be ward of the states when it comes to their health, because we won't be able to put them in, because once you start reaching the 1,000, you're talking about almost a rent payment. So to ensure my daughters, you know, we're going to have to put a, you know, I mean, it's going to supersede saving for college if we don't want them to go to the doctors that they allow us, you know, to live off the government. Or, you know, like my dad said, well, you know, those lazy little kids, they need to get a job in order for them to have affordable care, because otherwise, you know, we're always going to be paying a premium amount of money without employers actually contributing to premiums, to monthly premiums. I mean, and believe me.
No, I get what you're saying there. This is a real dilemma, and yeah. I'm not sure who this serves. Michael, can I call on you for a minute to
I'm listening, Lewis, and your story, you know, it's you know, a purple New Hampshire versus a blue California, one's has its own exchange, one doesn't. You would think our experiences would be dramatically different, and yet, you know, you could the details are different, but fundamentally the nightmare feeling
exactly.
of this is very similar. You know, there's something about all of this that bothers me, and it's a little bit of Monday morning quarterbacking. But much of the sale around the Affordable Care Act was the idea that we needed, you know, we would insure the uninsured. And maybe this is my narrative in hindsight, but I always felt that there was this incredible number of people who could not afford insurance, living in poverty or near poverty, who had no way. And that we really needed to provide. And by the way, at the other end, you know, old people and young people, demographically varied, who could not afford insurance. And the target was to, you know, in some way there was a feel around Obamacare that it was almost like a poverty assistance program in some ways. Like it would help people who were in poverty deal with a major expense that people need. And there was very, very little talk, except in homily and promise, about what the impact would be on the middle class. And I just find a tremendous irony here that this particular administration really did not pay attention to what I think were very predictable consequences, unintended consequences, very predictable unintended consequences of the middle class. And now I feel terrible. And Debbie Lynn, you made a comment earlier that really sort of points up the guilt, right? Which is mm-hmm. you feel like you should, because people like you need to sign up. Healthy people need to sign up
right.
in order for this whole thing to work.
Exactly.
And so I'm sitting here going, I'm getting hurt. Lewis, a middle-class guy, is getting hurt. Debbie Lynn, you're a middle-class woman. You're going to get hurt. But I feel like we're supposed to suck it up to make sure that people who are really in need, as if we aren't sometimes, get what they have. And now this is kind of all coming out. And I find all of this to have been incredibly predictable. Janine, you mentioned the earlier Facebook postings, and the person I was going back and forth with, Greg Rusak, is a friend of mine, and we've spoken with him a number of times. He too was talking about how this isn't really the Affordable Care Act. It's really, it's Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield in my case, or whatever your insurance company is, Lewis, in your case. They're really, if insurance companies weren't run as a profit-making business, then we wouldn't be in this situation. The middle class wouldn't get hurt. But all of that was predictable because the ACA was mm-hmm. written partly to include the insurance industry, partly by the insurance industry, and certainly there's a lot of protection for the insurance industry. Theoretically, they're getting, 30 million new customers. So I have to believe that people sat around at some table. Either it was, the health insurance equivalent of the Cuban Missile Crisis, in which everybody thought it was a great idea and nobody listened to anybody else's voice, any dissenting voice, or they actually said, we know that there's going to be a hit on the middle class, but we have to play that down. We got to play this up as something to get these, the people who really need it covered. But this has just not been good for a lot of people.
There's an irony, and I'll tell you, the continuation of the story of my parents. My dad had an aneurysm about 2 years ago.
Oh, wait, can I interrupt you just a second? Can I interrupt you just a second?
Sure.
I just want to say to our listeners that we have a one-hour show in a two-hour window, and so Debbie Lynn and I have agreed to run over today. It's just important that I give you, I need to give a couple of announcements, and then we'll come right back to you, Lewis. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay, great. So I want to remind people that there are other Coffee Party Internet Radio Network shows that they might be interested in listening to. Mondays, Dan Aronson hosts Press 1 for Democracy, 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. Thursdays, Here You Are, Lunch with Loudon. And Saturday, Egberto Willis hosts Politics Done Right, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Coffee Party USA is a totally grassroots-funded organization. Citizens United has not benefited us. If you'd like to be a part of our crowdsourcing effort, you can become a member or you can make a contribution. Either way, you can go to www.coffeepartyusa.com and find your way to joining the party, so to speak. That's my abbreviated announcement. And so, Lewis, we're back to you.
Well, I just wanted to touch on what the gentleman said. The irony, my dad had an aneurysm 2 years ago, so he had 12 weeks of get better or die type of thing that insurance policies have. Of course, he didn't get better, but he lived. So he has no insurance. And you know what? Without Obamacare, without anything, and of course now he's poor, the whole family helps him. He used to be a CPA. Now he can't work. He found a way to get treatment. He found a way to see doctors. He didn't need Obamacare to do this. We already had, LA Cares. We already had, the Memorial Hospitals. Yes, it took 6 months to see a specialist. But you know what? It's still going to take him 6 months to see a specialist because now when he applied to Obamacare, he doesn't make the required income to even qualify to buy insurance.
Right. He's in that donut hole. Go ahead, Damien.
Well, I just have a question for Michael and for you, Lewis, and that is, I've been kind of hoping that Obamacare is kind of messy for a while so that we actually can make then the next step towards single payer, kind of like Medicare for all, and then people can buy their additional insurance policies that they, if they want to ramp up, they get that basic coverage, just, part of our social safety net. What do you guys think about that? I mean, having gone through this experience now, trying to do this hybrid thing.
If I can go first, because I have to go to go. I just think that my parents meant the best for me when they lied, but they were still lying. So, it might be the best system in the world. I mean, I know that it works in Mexico, it works in Finland, it works in London, but we were lied to. You know, when we casted our votes, and I didn't vote for Obama the second time, but when we casted our votes, it was under lies. And that is to me, in essence, is, I mean, you would not trust a boyfriend who cheated on you. And that's exactly what Obama has done to us. You know, he enamored us, and then he lied. And if this is the means to get to a single payer, that we will all live in paradise, it's not the way to do it, because we are going to see my sister-in-law lose her home. We're going to see us. I don't know how we're going to pay for it. You know, you're going to see my brother having to move to Phoenix to be able to pay for something that may be paradise down the road under the veil of lies. And that's it.
Thank you so much for calling in, Luis. And thanks for staying with us while we ask you these questions.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. So my sort of observation right now is, of course, everybody knows that my mission in life is to expose money and politics. And sometimes I don't want to get into too many conspiracy theories, but I really, Michael, what you said about the Cuban Missile Crisis for insurance companies rang a bell with me because, you know, again, the reason I gave the background at the beginning of the show was because we needed to remember, be informed in this conversation by the fact that this started out very different and morphed towards this industry model. And I don't know who made health insurance the poster boy for entrepreneurship or private enterprise, but this has been a very profits-oriented, highly successful in bringing in cash business model for a long time. And the idea that these that policies are canceled instead of modifying, the idea that providers actually opted out of markets. You know, that New Hampshire has one provider now. I mean, how crazy is that? What, how free market is that? Until Greg in this conversation that Michael and I have referred to basically said, I'm going to paraphrase, all health insurance company decisions are marketing and sales and profit decisions. They are not about care. They are not about your well-being. They are not about a national safety net. They are about profitability. He pointed to the fact that there are mutual companies and there are traded companies, and that the mutual companies and the traded companies are different. But what we see in a lot of these single vendor states, and even in Oregon, when you look at the exchange, are the big boys, the big boys. And so you know that there's profitability here, as long as they can wrangle the system they want. I think that was an influence in why the Supreme Court ultimately upheld Obamacare rather than, send us back to the drawing board. I really think that the Chief Justice saw that we figured out these things, Michael, that you called predictable. And this would have been a failure of Obamacare, and the Supreme Court would have been called back to Medicare for All. So I know you sort of got cut short in your last answer. What, maybe you could take it from there, Michael.
Yeah, so, Debbie Lynn, actually, I'll ask you for a question first. Define what you mean by single payer, because I've heard the term thrown around a lot, and I'm not suggesting you're throwing it around, but I just want to make sure we're talking about the same thing.
Yeah, no, I just think that that if we did a provided basic Medicare coverage for everyone, that is kind of like the base that people that live in this country and pay taxes get, our children, et cetera. And then let the private industry take on the supplemental policies, which is what senior citizens have. You know, my dad has that plan now, and he decides what level of supplemental policy he wants and can afford. But that gets basic coverage for everyone, so we stop having the overrun emergency rooms, where people are using them for urgent care centers for things that shouldn't be in the ER, and then to me that's just a better solution than this anomaly that we have now.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Single payer to me is really contains a couple of individual elements that I think are the important things and don't require single payer as an umbrella, in my opinion. And I'm no expert at this, but Lewis, who just got off, is definitely more of an expert than I am. What I'm What I'm interested in is single negotiator. That, to me, is the real key. To me, there are three really important pieces to the healthcare problem, the healthcare system problem. And I want to be clear. I think we have some of the greatest healthcare in the world. I think it's our healthcare system that sucks. There's a big difference in my mind. The inability by legislation, by the way, and this is where, you know, the lobbies and the money have had the biggest influence, is the inability to allow even a state government, in most cases, but certainly the federal government, to negotiate en toto across the healthcare system. And even if you adjust for regionalization and demographics and different rates, so that California is certainly more expensive than New Hampshire, so is New York and New Jersey, the inability to negotiate on a grand scale makes it very difficult to keep costs down. And fundamentally, isn't this what this is all about? If costs were really, really low, more people would have coverage, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that single payer doesn't solve anything unless it includes a single negotiator provision. And if you have a single negotiator provision, I don't know why I would want the federal government handling all of the payouts. And that scares me a little bit because it means to me that we now have a payout system that is subject to Tea Party hijacking, for example. I don't necessarily want to see that money have to come from the federal government before it gets to me. I would rather have it come from my insurance company and let the insurance company deal with getting it from somebody else. It's too big a tempting pile of money in our current economic climate for people to want to screw around with. But anyway, that's a side note. Negotiation is the big one for me, single negotiator. The second one for me, and I know I've gotten a lot of pushback on this, is tort reform. Okay? And I'm very, very aware, by the way, before anybody out there either yells on the chat room or into their phones, that the fundamental savings of tort reform are very, very, very small. So the direct savings from tort reform, the amount of money that's actually spent as a share of healthcare costs to pay out claims against tort reform is infinitesimal, right? But however, because we don't have tort reform, we have an incredible amount of money being spent on defensive medicine. Okay? And what I mean by defensive medicine is when you go in and you get extra tests. You get everything done
right.
Because they're covering their butts. And I went through this personally a few years back. I had a lingering cough, an annoying chronic cough that wouldn't go away. And I went to the doctor, and the doctor said, and I'm paraphrasing, but it roughly went like this: it's probably nothing. Most coughs like this, apparently your coughing mechanism can develop as a habit. So if you have a real cough, the muscles actually get trained to cough. And so when the illness, when the underlying cause goes away, the cough doesn't. And this is very common.
Yes. Yes.
But they wanted to make sure that I didn't have COPD. Having nothing in my history, having been a hiker and an exerciser, and I had that sort of thought about, well, I can take control of my own health care. But then you also say, well, my doctor knows more than I do. So I went and had the test. They sent me to have a test with this big apparatus for COPD. It was a $1,700 test.
Yes.
Which had about a 1 in 1 quintillion chance of actually being necessary, that I actually had COPD. That's defensive medicine. And so if you have tort reform, you remove some of the fear from the system, you remove potentially a chunk of defensive medicine from that. And the third piece is the supply chain for insurance costs itself. I have a customer that I work with in the insurance business. In this case, it's disability insurance, which is only tangentially related. But the number of hands that policy goes through, the number of different organizations and companies who are each taking a piece of something, there can be 6 companies taking a piece of profit out of a single policy.
Yes.
That's systemically insane. I think the single payer answer is an umbrella that a lot of people think will solve problems, but maybe people haven't really thought through the specifics of what some of those problems are. And for me, again, being, you know, just a guy who thinks about this stuff but isn't an expert, those, I think if you address some of those underlying issues like single negotiator, defensive medicine, supply chain, policy supply chains, you can take pretty good cuts at some of those costs without necessarily having to go to a single-payer system.
Well, you know, that brings up so much for me, Michael, because, you know, there's a single-payer versus Medicare for All. Medicare for All is really, unless you're on Medicare, you may not realize how privately incentivized it is. I mean, there's basic Medicare, Medicare A, that is a government payment plan, and then you start branching out Medicare B, C, D. And I couldn't agree with you more about your terms, you know, what the terms should be. And, you know, even just to apply these to Medicare would be brilliant, because Medicare D, I think, is one of the biggest examples of denial in our the value of negotiation. You know, the federal government would not use its buying power to negotiate drug prices.
Absolutely.
And if you want to recall, and that vote, the vote on Medicare D went, you know, a vote is usually open 15 minutes at the most. That vote was open for hours and hours, and people were changing their votes, and people were being drug out of the halls of Congress into offices of the Speaker to change their votes. There was such a huge, what do you want to call it? I could not believe the people who wanted to take away our negotiating power as a group.
Oh, Janine. Janine.
Go ahead.
Of course you can believe the people.
Of course.
You know who they are. It's the
insurance
lobbies.
Companies.
It's the insurance.
Right,
it's the
right.
Lobbies. So, sure. Absolutely.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's the thing. It's like, if you want to sit here and say Congress is doing its job, then and you should hold congressmen accountable, well, okay. But it is the insurance lobby is humongous. The guy who runs Humana makes in one day what the average American worker makes in a year. Now, you can't tell me that this isn't a profit-driven legislation. And so what happened, you know, my dismay when the whole let's change something about the healthcare system debate started was that these are the people that Congress was listening to. They were listening to Humana. They were listening to United Healthcare. They were listening to all these, I consider them vipers in business. And, you know, there's a gazillion good businesses out there. There's a gazillion good people, business people out there. And who are we listening to? Snidely Whiplash, you know? And so I see the breakdown in Obamacare to be exactly what they were looking for and what they lobbied for, and they got as much of it as they could before, you know, it just couldn't go on any longer. This legislative battle could not go on any longer. And so I'm with you. I have mixed emotions about how to take our system, you know, which was passed, was confirmed in election, was confirmed by the Supreme Court. Now, how do we morph this into something where there isn't this huge donut hole that allows children and people, the working poor, right? Not the disabled poor, not the whatever, but the working poor, to be left out in the cold? This was never our intention, as you said, Michael. And so that one's a frustration. And I have to tell you, as being new to Medicare, the system is so complex. I hired a Medicare coach to help me select.
There's
so
a business
convoluted
opportunity I hadn't thought of.
Oh, listen, Michael, do it. Because
no, thank
woman,
you.
Well, but I'm just saying, you know, it would be an interesting talent. This woman that I found, she's a broker, but her thing is, I'll help you choose the right Medicare. I'll help you choose the right Oregon Exchange program. You know, she's a trained navigator, and she's a broker for all these companies. And when I tell her my story, right, these are the meds I take, these are my pre-existing conditions, so to speak, this is my health profile, this is what I do, she can actually say, this is the plan for you, and here's why, and show you the math. And so I had to do that for Medicare. And because in Medicare, husband and wife are not on the same policy, they are unique, I had to do that for my husband. And then now for my children, I'm enlisting her, I'm engaging her to help my children discover, you know, $10 more here or $20 more here buys you this much more coverage for what's important to you. And without that kind of educated navigator, it's like a harbor master. You know, they're like a harbor master in this huge body of water that we can't even, that we're only now trying to navigate. So I don't think everybody can afford that. Now, I've heard of several people say that the navigators that you get a hold of on the telephone if you're using an exchange or if you're using the federal site are good at what they're doing. But like Louise said, call back, or no, who said it? Call back in the middle of the night. Oh, it was you, Michael. So I'm not sure where we've left this other than I've learned a lot today about things I didn't know because they didn't pertain to me. You know what I'm saying? And dilemmas people are facing, like Debbie Lynn, with having to consider penalty versus purchase. And people like Louise, who have to actually want to, who want to play and are being forced out by the fine print. Anything more you'd like to say, Michael, about this subject before we start to bring it to a close?
Just one quick comment. I would like everyone to know that I am not an anti-Obamacare or Affordable Care Act person, but neither am I an apologist for the program. It has done a tremendous amount of good for a tremendous number of people, and it is to be lauded for that. It has undergone the kind of abuse that, you know, if it were a child, it would have been taken away from its parents. I mean, what this program has had to go through to get where it is through Congress and everything else. But I would caution everybody who has either a purely horrible story or a purely horrible view or a purely perfect view that it is neither of those things. And in my opinion, things like 26 years old, pre-existing conditions, all that stuff, we should never, ever take that away. Those are wonderful things. They're part of an important social safety net. But there are big, big pieces of this law that need to be changed, that need to be amended. And the idea that Obamacare shouldn't be on the table, I think, is a blanketly naive statement. I think it does need to be on the table. I just hope that the table that it's at has reasonable people sitting around it.
Oh, thanks, Michael. So listen, while I just looked at our board again, and there is a new person on our 908. I'm coming to you now.
I can stay on until the half hour, if you want to take another.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. So, 908, welcome to Lunch with Loudon. With whom am I speaking?
This is Chad Lang from New Jersey.
Hey, Chad.
Hey,
Chad, how are you?
Okay, I just want to pipe in real quick. I don't know if I didn't hear the whole show, but I'm not, I'm on Medicare, so I guess the Affordable Act doesn't really apply to me or whatever. But my wife is Portuguese, and we were in Portugal this summer, and I never thought that I always thought, I guess, being America-centric, that it was better for her to be married to me than me to be married to her. Boy, was I wrong. I have universal health care in Europe because of my wife. And I went to a doctor while I was over there. Actually, I've been to quite a few doctors over there. And last year I had one of my legs stripped, the veins stripped out of it. And the cost over here was $27,000. And over there, first of all, they don't do one leg at a time. They do two legs at the same time. And they said, the doctor said, tried to be as diplomatic as he could to say, we have a different approach to medicine in America, in Portugal, than you have in America. We're doctors. We're well respected. We live in nice houses and we have a car. In your country, they have lots of houses and lots of cars, and money is the most important thing. You could have both legs stripped here for $4,000, or you could wait, get in the queue, and have it done for free. I was like, oh my God. This is crazy. And the elephant in the room, I actually don't even think it's bigger than an elephant, is that our entire country is based on, I mean, I don't think really capitalism works without our government, because our government makes everything about money. And whether we like it or not, none of us get out of this alive. We're all going to die of something. We're all going to get sick. And this should not be about money. This, of all things, should not be about money. It should be a single payer. We all pay a tax or whatever, and everybody gets care until it comes to the day that you die. And this whole thing about giving just vast amount of money to the insurance companies, let the insurance sell flood insurance and boat insurance and stuff like that, not health insurance. It's wrong. It's absolutely wrong. And that's my spiel.
Well, it's nice to have some insight from, you know, we hear stories about what it's like other places. I have a similar story from my husband in Canada. He was actually just traveling, had an issue that needed medical attention, went to the doctor, mm-hmm. asked to pay, and they said, have a good time in Canada. That was it.
Yeah.
You know, if they took care of him for nothing. So, I mean, I know that there are pros and cons, but I appreciate your input, because I think sometimes we get sort of down in the, you know, hunkered down in the foxhole and sort of forget there are mm-hmm. other ways of looking at this. So thanks, Chad.
Yep. Okay. Carry on. Coffee party on, excuse me. I got that wrong.
You did. Absolutely. So listen, our board is lighting up. Which we tried to sign off, and all of a sudden the board lit up. So listen, I've got one more, and then we're going to have to close pretty soon, but thank you very much. I'm opening an electronic call. Is this Luis again, or am I speaking to someone new?
No, it's Brown Beasley, the Brown Beasley. How are you?
Okay. I'm
good.
Great.
Good. I just wanted to mention, you know, I clicked on your link here, and I started listening to your show. Well, I saw the show description. I was like, oh, my God, more people screaming and hollering about Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. And then I listened for a moment, and I'm like, oh, okay, these people kind of understand that this is the law and that they're, you know, being compelled to comply, and that for some of us, even though we have reservations about, we may have reservations, that we're realized that how this can benefit, you know, at least it would benefit me, being self-employed, being a man of a certain age, and not carrying health insurance because of the expense, and also because I'm in, you know, fairly good health, and I pay out of my pocket to get, you know, regular checkups a few times a year. And I also, you know, take medication for high blood pressure, which, you know, is all affordable. But I commend you first on that. And I think the gentleman said, you know, it's a fact. And, you know, you go to these other shows and you hear people like it's like fighting what already happened. You know, it's reality, it's here. And if you listen to any of these other shows on BTR, most of the talk about it, instead of what you're doing, and I'm going to listen to your show afterwards, is practical. Having to navigate through this maze and maybe some of the problems that it has, with these websites in particular, and why they get the bugs out. And eventually, they're going to get the bugs out, hopefully. In different places, you have different problems, and some places aren't having problems at all. That's all. I just wanted to commend you on taking a practical approach to the reality that this is the law. And to try to take a, you know, and to face it, instead of all I'm hearing other else is sour grapes and complaining and trying to dismantle something that's not going to be dismantled easily. It's the law. It's happening. It's real. It's here. It's time to deal with it. And I think that's the attitude that your show has taken, at least the people that I hear calling in. Am I correct?
Oh, you are. And that's high praise, Brown. So thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're welcome.
Thanks for calling in.
Very good.
Okay, so there's one caller that's been on the phone the entire time. We told him we might come back, so I'm going to go to Jack and say, Jack, do you have 25 last words for us before we sign out? I'm opening your mic now. Jack, are you with us?
Hello. Yeah. Well, I forgot to tell you, I have an $8,000 bill from Pioneer Manor, the nursing home. And I know this is not covered by Medicare. And my income is too high for wanted to take out the whole pension.
Jack, I'm quieting your mic right now because there's so much background noise that we actually couldn't hear what you were saying. So I apologize, and thank you so much for calling in and being a faithful listener and a good contributor. So thank you very much. Debbie, do you have any last words before we go?
Well, I think this has been very educational today, so I appreciate Michael and Luis and Brown and Jack for calling in and sharing their experiences with us and actually kicking me in the rear end to go on and look and see what's it going to cost for me and discovering what I needed to discover. So thanks. I'm glad to have been here with us all today.
Yeah, I think it's been magnificent. I still want to say one last thank you to Michael Charney, our So, Michael, you call yourself what is the term for celebrity?
An incredibly minor public figure.
There you go. So, Michael Chiry, an incredibly minor public figure. Thank you. Thank you so much. You've added so much.
You're very welcome.
Today.
Thanks for inviting me. It was fun.
You're welcome. So, listen, everyone, it's that time again. Thank you so much. It's important to me that we keep this conversation in the vein of inciting civility and reason. I have not been disappointed. Thanks so much for who you are in the world. Coffee party on.